Blog Talk Radio.
Hi, I'm Laura Mize. Welcome to Teach Me to Talk with Laura and Kate. Kate, are you there?
I'm here. I'm Kate
Hempler.
Oh, we still have our music going, don't we? Guess we'll yell over it. Just be like somebody's home. Okay, I'm Kate Hensler. I'm a developmental interventionist, and I work for the First Steps program in the state of Kentucky. How are you doing, Laura?
I'm really good. I'm very excited that we're here at 2 o'clock Eastern time instead of our 6 o'clock Eastern time that we've done for a few months now, and we're permanently moving the time of our show to this slot. We've had lots of parents kind of say that 6 o'clock Eastern time was really rough for them because that's the bewitching hour in lots of homes with dinner and with dad coming home and everybody getting in from the day. So we're hoping that 2 o'clock is right smack in the middle of nap time and so that more moms will get a chance to listen and to call in and just be more convenient for everybody. I was just thinking, though, that would put it, let's see, if we're 2 o'clock Eastern time, our friends in California would be 11 o'clock.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so maybe they can do this as their late morning before lunch rush. So, but I forgot to get a post up about that on the website. It's kind of hard for me to do new posts right now since we're doing that switch over.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't just normally pop up like it did. So sorry about that. If any of you are tuning in at 6 expecting it to be live, we were here for
it. We'll say as steady a time, consistent a time as possible. Both of us have lives, and occasionally things come up, but we're going to try and stick to 2 o'clock Eastern time from now on.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's our new time slot, so there you go. All right. I do want to also share that there's cable work going on in my neighborhood, and my internet and phone are likely to go out at any time, and if that happens, Kate's just going to talk until I call back, so if you lose me, I'll be right back within a minute or so. And I do want us to start the show today by thanking Glenn, who is the dad that was on our show last week, and he was so gracious to call in and tell us his story and kind of open his heart and bare his soul right here on the air. And we so appreciate his time and, again, willingness to share and ask his questions. And we were able to correspond with him after the show as well and give him some new ideas and more specific things that we were thinking that as the show progressed. And so, again, we just want to thank him once more for doing that for us. And if there are any other parents who want that kind of chance to talk about your kid or talk about your concerns or talk about what you might not be understanding or just get a second opinion, we would love to have you call in the show and do that. Let's get the call-in number. Do you have it there with you, Kate?
I do. It is 1-718-766-4332.
And we would welcome your questions, welcome your comments, your concerns. And what Glenn did is he sent me a pretty long email ahead of time so that I had lots of background and we could sort of think about his situation. And so, again, if you're too shy to call today, that might be a way to kind of put your feet in the water and go ahead and send us an email, and we'll read that and talk about that, and then be glad to have you on in an upcoming week to talk about your situation. Or if you don't even want to talk about it, but you just want to hear Kate and me talk about it, we've done that before, too, where we take emails and kind of pick them apart and do that, and we'd love to do that as well. And I love the shows best, I think, where we have guests and we have callers, and that's a lot of fun for us. So if you're thinking about it or want to do that, that's something that Kate and I would love to do.
I think that Glenn, well, first, he seemed to be a great dad and was so committed to helping his child, but I think he kind of reminded us, Laura, that here's obviously a very articulate, intelligent guy, and yet even with some help of other therapists, he still finds kind of this whole apraxia diagnosis confusing, you know, had hit a few stumbling blocks with therapy, and reminded us, yeah, you know, it's not so simple. It's not a black and white topic, and it can be very confusing to therapists and parents. So,
You know, and I have really been reminded about that as I've done this upcoming DVD, Teach Me to Talk with Apraxia and Phonological Disorders, and just how difficult it is to really explain it so that parents understand it. And, you know, every time I do a DVD or write an article for the website, and I don't think I gave out that address today, it's teachmetotalk.com. But when I really started thinking about doing all this a couple of years ago, and you'll probably remember this, Kate, I would talk about it and I would say, I've got to figure out what I really, really do and how I can boil that down and make it in everyday language so that parents can understand it and really explain, okay, this is what you're doing and this is why you're doing it and this is how you do it. And apraxia is so hard to get that, you know, get it into that little nutshell, because even the show that we did a couple of weeks ago, when I was out of town and I was kind of crazy anyway, just trying to get in there, it was so hard to even say what those characteristics were, because every time one came out of my mouth, I felt like I was saying, but, you know, really giving the exception to the rule, because there are so many different little nuances that children can have when they are diagnosed with verbal apraxia. None of those kids look alike. None of those kids make the same kinds of errors. And so that's why it's so challenging, you know, not only from a therapist perspective, you know, for us to talk about it and really wrap our arms around it, but when you have no background in this at all and you're a parent trying to understand it, you know, again, Glenn is smart. His questions were great.
I thought his voice sounded really good, too. I thought, oh, that man's voice sounds really... When I listened to the podcast, I hated how I sounded, and he sounded great. Laura, you sounded good, too, but he had that nice, strong male voice.
I know, and that's different than our little girl voices, huh?
Yeah.
But, you know...
Sorry, well, go ahead.
I'm sorry. I was just going to say, it's just so difficult to really explain it, but I did love getting a chance to talk to him about his specific questions, because, again, we've done this for a long time, and this is what we think about and do a lot, and it's still hard for us to kind of talk about it sometimes, so it certainly makes you appreciate where a parent's coming from when they're struggling trying to understand the diagnosis and then understand if this really fits their kid or not. And I think that's what his big concern was is, excuse me, he had listened to the previous podcast about apraxia, but then he still had those questions about, is this what really is going on with my kid, or could it be something else? So I really loved having him call and talk about that. And, again, any other parent that wants us to do that, it doesn't have to be, you know, specifically about questions about apraxia. Anything that's going on with your toddler or young preschooler, we'd love a whack at that, and we'll be glad to talk you through it, with the caveat being it's very hard to make really black and white statements about a kid that we've not seen. I'm so sorry. I can't believe I've still got this allergy thing going on. So we can just talk about kind of generalities and, you know, what we're thinking from what a parent tells us, with no parent thinking that we're really specifically going to, quote-unquote, diagnose their kid. So there you go. All right. Are you still there?
I'm here.
Okay.
I didn't know if you had anything to add to that.
I'm trying not to choke and talk at the same time, so I'm going to take a little drink real quick. Okay, today we're going to pick back up with apraxia and talk about specific strategies for intervention or the therapy, what you do once you feel like that your child maybe has apraxia and your speech pathologist has worked with you on that diagnosis and says, gosh, this is what I think it is. And if you'll remember, we've talked about this before, lots of experts in the area of childhood apraxia really don't feel that a child can be adequately or accurately diagnosed when they're not quite three yet. So, the preferred term would be suspected childhood apraxia of speech, but I'm not going to say that today. I'm just going to keep using the term apraxia, and so you'll know that that's, again, sometimes some people feel that you should wait until after three to officially diagnose that, but that doesn't mean that you don't go ahead and implement the therapy strategies that might be helpful. And we talked a couple of weeks ago about that sometimes those are not the same strategies that you would typically implement for a child that you felt was just language delayed, because apraxia, as you'll remember, is a speech disorder versus a language disorder, And so you'll want to do some other really specific things to get those sounds and get those verbalizations going. All right. We're talking today from the article on the website, and it's called Successful Speech Therapy Strategies for Working with Toddlers with Apraxia and Other Speech-Language Difficulties. So if you want to take a look at that as your reference after the show, this is kind of where we're pulling the information from.
And Laura, are listeners able to search that at this point, or they need to go to that drop-down box and hit Apraxia and then...
They're going to need to go to the drop-down box, I think, because, you know, as we talked about before, my website is being converted over to the new template. And, again, that's much easier said than done. And every category has to be entered, excuse me, so that kind of global search feature I don't think is enabled right now. So you'll go to the new homepage at teachmetotalk.com and then scan down to the bottom and find one of the little icons that says Learn More. Click that, and then you'll go to our old homepage, and there you'll see the categories, I think. You know, I'm looking at that right now, and I don't even think the categories are up anymore.
Hmm. Now, I went to the Teach Me to Talk site, and there's a box that says search, but if you push the arrow, you get a drop-down. It says choose one or something like that. And there's autism and then apraxia. And if you click on apraxia, it goes to all the related articles. But they have to keep at the bottom of each list of article titles, it says read more or older entries. And you push older entries, and it's like the third screen. So this was one you wrote pretty early on when you were creating your website, I think.
Right. And thank you for giving those specific instructions. And I'm trying to go there now.
And if I can do it, anybody listening can do it. So. Trust me on that. You don't have to be great on the computer. I did find it. So it's out there.
Yeah, and just do that. And if you're having difficulty with that, email me at laura@teachmetotalk.com, and I'll send you that article and so that you can take a look at that. I won't be able to do it as a talk on the air because goodness knows I can not do that. I'll send it to you after the show so that you can take a look at that. And, again, I'm hoping that I think our date – Johnny, when's the date on the website to be converted? I think it's August 17th or 18th that should be completely done. So there's an end inside, and all the search features should be back up, and we'll have our new look going, and things will be a little easier to navigate at that point. Okay, but Kate, did you find the article? Is that why you were saying that?
Yes.
Okay, good. I was going to say, if not, we'll have Johnny shoot you that link right now, but okay, you've got it too. All right, so let's start talking about what we do for toddlers that we suspect have apraxia. And I do want to say, again, that when we would look at apraxia for a kid, sometimes apraxia is the only issue that a child has, and that it's just really at that point an expressive speech-language disorder, meaning that there's some language components, there's some speech components, or apraxia can be part of a bigger issue for a child. And I've talked a lot about that in the first section of this article because parents who are dealing with a child that has multiple concerns for them don't necessarily need to think about treating apraxia or the speech component first. First, with some kids, you've got to go back and look at that interaction piece. And I think that's one thing that Glenn shared with us last week is that his therapist early on really kind of talked about that, and they felt like that had gotten better. But if you have a kid that who's not looking at you, who's not really getting joy from playing with you, who's not lighting up and having twinkly eyes, you know, you really need to start with those social games and with those things that kind of hook him, because no amount of the strategies or techniques that we're going to talk about today will result in speech or language that's meaningful until you get that interaction piece in. And I think, Kate, you and I had a discussion about that earlier in the week where we were talking about that, just how critical those interaction skills are for any kid, regardless of what the diagnosis is. You've got to start with that foundation of shared interest and, again, a kid has to be able to connect with you and interact with you before he's going to be able to talk.
And I do think that that is oftentimes overlooked or not necessarily given the emphasis from providers, from therapists, and from family members. You know, they think, oh, I just want him to talk, and they don't necessarily get the importance of, and well, if he's not connected to you socially, then even if he got words, they wouldn't be meaningful or they wouldn't be communicative. But probably the child isn't going to get words until you've got that piece pretty firmly intact. You know, that's got to be pretty easy for a child. And I've had very, 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 very few kids over the years that I couldn't get that going with some work and some focus and some effort. Normally, it may not be an instinct for a child. It may not be easy for a child. You may have to really, really target that and focus that social connection. But if you do, almost every child I've ever seen could get that. You know, sometimes it has to be almost taught, but it can be taught.
It can. And, you know, we did a lot of shows about that last fall where we were talking about autism, and then I think even earlier ones than that when we first started last August or September, and we talked about ways to kind of elicit those social reactions. And again, you know, we want to see a kid, and as we always say, with twinkly eyes and, you know, really looking at us and really lighting up, and again, really appearing to be totally into and totally connected to what we're doing. And so if you're listening to this because you want specific techniques to work on speech with your kid and you're not seeing that with him, that's where you need to start, because everything else is not going to fall into place like it would. And so you can bang your head against the wall trying to do these strategies. And I think this is helpful information even for therapists. And you just said that, Kate, sometimes providers don't even emphasize, or maybe kind of even gloss over themselves, what an important piece that social connection is. And your time is not wasted in therapy, and it's certainly not wasted as a parent for that to be your goal right away, is that until you get that going, you're really not going to worry about all this other stuff, because it is such a critical foundational skill. And there's some ideas in the article about that. There's some other things on the site that teachmetotalk.com, some other things that you can look at. And again, if you're a parent in that situation and you want some more specific information about that, please email me, and I'll be glad to send you those links. And maybe that's something that we'll devote another show to in the future, is really talking about how to get those social connections and those interactive skills. But that's not the purpose of today's show. We're going to skip on now to talk about the things that we do for children that we feel like that apraxia or just the expressive part is their main issue. So we know that a kid's already interactive at this point, and you know what else I forgot to talk about? Comprehension. If a kid is not understanding language, he's not ready to use language. You know, kids first have to interact, then they have to understand, and then they're ready to talk. So, again, you want to be sure that your child has the social piece and that language comprehension is there. And maybe, you know, I'm not saying put off working on words or signs until you get, you know, until you're absolutely sure that he understands everything at an age-appropriate level. But, again, your main problem is not talking when a child is not able to follow directions. Your main issue really should be comprehension at that point, and that's what you should work really, really hard on. And again, not that we wouldn't push the words at the same time, but comprehension and interaction are those pieces that you have to really, really have in place before you start using the techniques that we're talking about here.
And again, I think that is oftentimes overlooked too. And it's, you know, parents, I get it. I would feel exactly the same way. I want them to talk. I want them to talk. I want them to talk. And nobody really wants to hear. Well, we want them to talk too, but first we have to focus on what he's understanding, or at least, as you said, do that in conjunction with the focus on expressive language, because, you know, and we've talked about this many times also on the show about sometimes parents assume because he knows that the round thing over there is a ball, he also knows all these other words, the meaning of all these other things. And sometimes that is the case and sometimes it isn't. And I think that the biggest way to know is if you use those words, whether individually or in a short phrase, if your child responds to it, if he points to it, if he reaches for it, if you say, get it, and he gets it, if he's going to respond to what you say, then you can begin to assume, yeah, he pretty much does get what I say, you know, but just because he can follow one simple command, get the ball, may not mean he can get the shoe and the horse and the duck and the cow and the tractor and the jeep and the whatever else. So
right.
Keep that in mind. That is certainly an important part of the puzzle.
Exactly. And that's something that, you know, earlier in my career, I might not have been as clear with parents about either. But now I certainly hope that I'm doing a much better job talking about all the things that have to be in place first before we start working on or at least really in conjunction with working on words. You know, those pieces are that important and that critical. And, you know, sometimes when we meet a kid, when we do an assessment, now I'll flat out say to a parent, you know, talking's not our main issue here. Or it's going to be, I want to hear words too, but guess what? That's going to be further down the road. And I think that's hard for a lot of therapists to say. And it certainly was not easy for me to say earlier in my career. And I think you'll agree with that as well, Kate.
I still struggle with it. I try and get it out on some level, but I probably am not as succinct as you are. I think that is important to say because it does kind of alert parents to knowing, okay, maybe it's not all talk, 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 but it is hard to say because that is not what parents want to hear, and I wouldn't want to hear it either if it were my child.
I know, and it breaks their heart because a little part of their dream has died. And when they have really held on to the fact that if he would just talk, everything else is going to be okay. And even if they've had those red flags and maybe get the feeling in the pit of their stomach like, okay, he's not just a late talker here, we might be talking about something else. You know, that's really hard for a parent to hear. And sometimes I think when we say that to parents, we almost have to give them time to kind of digest that information and then say, but we're going to show you how to do that, and we're going to help you do that, and we're going to get there. You just have to know that this is a lot more complex than just being able to, today while I'm here, teach him to say five new words. So,
right. And on a positive note, I'm sure you've seen this because you deal with so many parents who are really on top of things, but when I have parents who really do digest that and factor that into how they relate to their child on a daily basis, oftentimes you do see their comprehension bump up pretty quickly because they're doing the things that we suggest that to help a kid get it faster. And you go, wow, in 3 months, you know.
He made 6 months progress or 9 months progress. Yeah.
Right. So that can be, you know, it's not certainly not always an easy fix, but sometimes really all it takes is for parents to have kind of their eyes open to, this is also a concern, and here are some things you can do to help that, and boom, it does get better pretty quickly.
Right, and you've got a little guy like that on your caseload right now, don't you?
Yeah.
Where you were really concerned early on that he did not have that social piece and that connection, and he's doing so much better with that now, isn't he?
Right, the social piece is so much better. I mean, he's a cutie pie. I absolutely adore working with him. And his comprehension has come quite a ways, too. I mean, he's really struggled initially. He was just under two when I evaluated him for the first time. And, you know, he had some comprehension, but he really was not at the two-year-old level. And I think his mom did kind of know it, you know, because
right.
It was her second child, and her first child was ahead of the game, was really, really, really verbal early on and really, and to this day is really, really verbal and a great student. And she kind of said, I'm not so sure it's just the talking. I kind of wonder if he really, but just in maybe 3.5-4 months, he's gone from getting a few words to getting lots. You know, he really is understanding so much more. So, and I think that's because they kind of decided, okay, we're going to target that as you know, they work on the expressive stuff as I've asked them to, but they've really focused on the receptive stuff also. So it's all getting better.
Yeah, that is great, and that's so good to have a real life story for you to be able to share like that and say, you know, that's made a big difference. And boy, it's so much easier to start working on these expressive things and, you know, these motor speech strategies when you have all that other stuff. You know, when that's all on its way to getting better, it makes the things that we're going to, I promise, start to talk about right now even better you know, and they just work. It's just easier at that point because a kid is ready at that point. They're really not ready before when they're struggling with social interaction and when they're struggling with comprehension. They're not ready for these things. So if you'll look at it like that and think about it in that way, but you're really pouring the foundation, it does make it a little easier when you do get them there. And it goes faster. It goes faster than you ever thought it would than if you had waited. It's like potty training. People who start potty training at some ridiculous age, like 18 months, guess what? They're still working on it at darn near 3 because they didn't really make sure that the child had the foundational things and was really, really ready. And that's kind of how I've come to view speech and language acquisition. You know, again, and that's not the best concrete example, but it's something that I think parents can relate to in that if they're ready, then it's so much easier than if you push all these things that they're not quite ready for. When you do get them really ready for that, it makes it a lot easier.
All right, Laura, okay. I'm going to slow you down for 1 second. I'm just going to say that if you happen to be listening to this and you have one of those little boys who wouldn't sit and look at pictures in a book if his life depended on it, you're thinking, great, how am I going to teach my kid to all these words, understand all this? Because he won't look at a book. And well, I know I've worked with a lot of little boys in particular, and sometimes girls who really aren't interested in those, oh, let's call them structured, more academic activities where they'll sit and they'll listen and they'll respond and they're just mesmerized by mommy reading the book because some kids just aren't there, you know?
Yeah.
May take them quite some time to get there. You have articles on your Teach Me to Talk website, but you also did, I guess, your second round of DVDs, which was Teach Me to Listen and Obey. And I think those are great examples for parents to see, well, it doesn't always have to look like some academic pursuit. It can be very playful, but you're still really targeting what your child understands. So if you're scratching your head saying, how in the world am I going to do that? That's just a little tidbit for anybody who's wondering, because I see those kids so often and the mom says, I try and read to them, and I think, yeah, it doesn't work, does it? So,
you know, this happened to me today. I was meeting one of my little clients out for a little community visit today, and the mom said, maybe we could do a book. Do you have any books in your toys today in your car? And I said, no, I don't have any books. I don't do books. I do books occasionally, and I do books if a kid really likes books, but I don't even use books that much. So, again, it really, you know, you need to think beyond that and think about it in the context of play, and we will talk about that right now. And that was
okay.
A great kind of segue.
Okay.
One thing that I talked about in this article that I kind of feel like it's important, but I was just thinking about the Apraxia DVD that I've just done. I don't really talk about this as a prerequisite skill on there, but if your child is not yet gesturing, that's another thing that you want to try to work on and incorporate too into your therapy time with him or your mommy therapy time, is really helping him learn to use gestures so that he's communicating non-verbally, expressively what he wants. And maybe that's where you got the book thing, Kate, as you were reading down when I was talking about how we model pointing and how we help kids learn how to point. But again, you can do it in ways, you know, on here I say point to pictures and books. And don't just stop there. Look at how you can get a kid to reach for things and point to things. And last week Glenn talked about his little boy leads him and really puts his hands on things. On one hand, I think that's great in that a child is gesturing and really telling you what he wants, but the other part of that is that you have to have a kid that has the joint attention piece too, that he's making eye contact with you and looking at you and really not just using you as that big old set of hands that can do things for him, you know, that social piece is there too. But again, gestures are an important way that children do start to communicate, and if I certainly have a kid who's not doing any of that, then that makes me think that they don't really have the intent piece. And by that, I mean that they don't ask for things because they don't even know how to initiate that with you. They don't know that that's even important, that they begin to show you or help you understand what they need. So that gesture piece, I'm thinking, oh boy, I got to go back and add a little section or two about that on the Apraxia DVD. That's making my heart beat a little bit fast thinking about that right now.
Well, and Laura, I'm going to go out on a limb here, and this is just my own little caveat, and I may be dead wrong, but I would say, in my experience, when I have worked with kids in the past and present, kids who I suspect are apraxic, if we're talking about apraxia that is kind of a standalone diagnosis.
Standalone, yeah.
Those kids tend to be pretty good gestures.
They are awesome, and you know, sometimes, yeah, that because they so get, I've got to make you understand because my mouth is not yet able to do these things, and so they are the kids that are pointing and leading you and making up their own little signs.
I've had a number of kids who I knew as I evaluated them, oh boy, I suspect that could be apraxia, but mom will say, well, when he wants to take a bath, he does this, and when he wants to watch The Wiggles or SpongeBob, or he does this. And he has all these little things, you know, 6, 7, 8, however many of them that he's figured out. Mommy gets it when I do this with my hands or this with my belly or whatever, you know, little thing they do.
Right.
And those kids, now those kids to me look, I mean, I would, in my little old simple mind, I would think those kids are classically apraxic.
Classically apraxic, yeah. And I think about kids in that way, too. And, you know, and again, some of the things that we're talking about, you know, when we're talking about, oh, all these other prerequisite skills, those would be kids that apraxia is part of the problem, not their only problem. And the kids that we're talking about now would be when apraxia really is all that's going on. It's just that motor speech disorder. So what you want to do is really make sure that when you are working on or thinking about your kid is, you know, thinking about them in that way. You know, is this the only problem or is this, again, just part of a bigger issue that I've got to work on? Okay, and there, if you have a kid that's not pointing, and again, I think, and this happens, I don't mean to keep referring back to Glenn, and I hope he doesn't feel self-conscious that we keep kind of rehashing his story here. But last week you talked about that his child really wasn't using lots of gestures, and that's one of the reasons that the occupational therapist and the speech pathologist felt that motor planning was the issue with him. Let's just say that sometimes kids don't do those things because of a dyspraxic problem, meaning that they have motor planning problems throughout their whole bodies. Sometimes they don't do it because they don't get it. They don't get, oh gosh, that point means that I want that. You know, they're just not that intentional yet. So if you have a child that's not doing lots of those gestures, it doesn't necessarily mean, oh, he's globally dyspraxic or he has global motor planning problems. That's it. That's it. That's just what we're going to call this. Again, that would be a kid who's got that as part of his problem, not his whole problem. Okay. Now, 30 minutes into the show, we can finally get to what we want to talk about.
Well, like we said, that did kind of remind us that it's a tangled web. There are lots of little pieces, and now we have gotten all these little prerequisite things that if they're not in place, we just want to alert listeners to target those at least at the same time that you're targeting expressive language, which is what we all really want anyway, but really can't get there unless you have these prerequisite skills. So.
Exactly. So if you have a kid that has all those things in place and it is just strictly verbal apraxia, let's talk about what we do. I think the most important thing that you can do for those kids is really be very, very, very playful and balance it with requiring them to attempt to verbalize and let you know what they want. Now, if you have a kid that's using lots of gestures, you're going to want to expand that by moving on to teaching sign language. And anybody that's listened to this show more than a minute knows that Kate and I are huge advocates of teaching children sign language and how important that is. It's important for children who don't have language, who don't have words at all, because it's a language problem. And I think it's even more important for children when there's a motor speech problem, when, again, they know what they want to say, they can't get it to their little mouths, it's somehow short circuits, for lack of a better word. We call that apraxia. And again, when we can get them to use signs, it often helps those words come. I am a simple person, and so I can't explain it in the same way that a neurologist would or a neuroscientist, but somehow when we start implementing those signs and we require that they do that to get something, it does somehow make it easier for those sounds to come. Don't you agree with that, Kate?
100%. Parents, you know, that's another one that isn't always embraced readily when I say, you know, we're going to introduce some simple signs, and because they think that we're teaching them to be signers and not talkers, and that is not at all the case. We are certainly focused on getting those words out as quickly as possible, but time after time after time, the signs that I push early on and the parents support in day in and day out are almost always the first words that those kids are going to use consistently. So, you know,
yeah,
the research indicates it, and real-life experience with kids on their living room floor indicates it really does work. So,
right. And, you know, one of the reasons or one of the things you see when you start to look in the apraxia literature or do, you know, find another website about apraxia like apraxia-kids.org, it talks about signs really start to serve as an anchor for those kids. I think that's the term that, do you know who I'm thinking of? Kate, Sharon Goetz, and I apologize to Dr. Goetz if I'm saying her name wrong. I'm sure I am since I'm doing both versions there, and I don't have it pulled up in front of me. But she really feels like that because children have that motor planning problem and they can't really, you know, remember the definition of that is that they can't plan it, sequence it, you know, they can't purposefully make those words come out, that the signs almost help them hold that word and anchor it in their little minds so that they start to associate. When I put my fingers together, Kate's always sitting there, or Mom's always sitting there saying more, and gosh, when my lips go together like that, somehow that little word is just easier to come out. So again, the sign helps to anchor that initial sound and that word, and so that kid can produce it sooner. So signing is something that I absolutely do with every kid that I suspect has motor planning problems. Even if I go in and the mom says, well, I don't know why we're doing that, because I understand everything that he wants, you know, just through his little system of gestures, maybe, you know, like you talked about. When he rubs his belly, he's hungry. When he scratches his arm, he's got to go. That means that he wants to take a bath. Or when he says, you know, that means this. All the things that moms have learned. It still is teaching them kind of a different way to use a motor movement, and again, that is what's going to make those new motor plans with their words and with their sounds. That's the piece that's going to make that better, is that you've taught them something new and you've taught them to use it purposefully, and they're able to do it and repeat it and do it and repeat it, and it makes that little neural pathway stronger, and they're able to associate those sounds and those words with that sign. Okay. My point with all this is when you have a kid that's not consistently verbalizing, and I don't mean not doing it because he won't do it. I mean he's not doing it because he can't do it. The signs, again, give him a really consistent way to respond so that you know what he wants. And, again, you're kind of requiring that child to respond. And I think that one difference with a therapist often makes the difference between, or with a mom, when you're going to successfully start to get those pretty consistent communicative attempts versus a therapist or a mom who's so laid back that never requires a child to say anything or do anything. And so, again, it's a little bit more aggressive or more assertive way to do it than, say, the people who just talk about narrating or, you know, observing and waiting and listening. You know, it's a different kind of in-your-face approach with those kids, but we never do that in a way that's, okay, and as I'm saying never, I'm thinking, okay, that's not necessarily true. Mm-hmm. We don't do it in a confrontational way that makes them less likely to want to participate with us. You still keep it fun. You still keep it exciting. You still keep them wanting to be there with you, but you are absolutely, quote-unquote, requiring them to do these things with you. And I think that makes a big difference with kids, don't you, Kate?
I think it's hugely important. And I do think I have one of my little catchphrases that I use with parents is, we can really not make him talk, but we can make him sign.
Right. We can. Well, you can take his hands and make him do it.
In a playful, fun way. Again, for listeners, any of your DVDs are going to demonstrate that, but you also have clips on your website, don't you? Where,
I do, and if you can't get it on the website, or it's hard for you to find, if you're on Facebook, go to teachmetotalk.com on Facebook, and the clips for all the DVDs are just there. Boom, 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 and you can become a fan there and then view all those clips, and you can watch those one after another and take a look at those and get really good ideas for how to make your play more playful but yet balance it with requiring a kid to participate. You know, I'm not big on just following a kid around and talking about what they're doing and hoping that in somewhere in there that they're going to pop a word back out to me. I am not a proponent of that at all. That just goes against everything that I believe to be true about children after doing this for so long. So you really do have to keep them engaged. And it is a little bit, you do want to follow a kid's lead in that you don't want to do everything that he hates. But at the same time, you want them there so that you are controlling what's going on and kind of making them, for lack of a better word, participate with you and try to do the things with you.
Well, in this case, it's so critical because we've already established when we were really talking about the definition of what does an apraxic kid look like. These are not imitators. They are not going to imitate words just because mommy or you or anybody else says ball, shoe, horse, dog. They may listen. They may understand the word, but they're probably not going to just sit around. And typically kids do a lot of imitation spontaneously,
Right, and
you
normal.
Say, uh-oh,
normal
and they say,
moment.
Uh-oh, outside, out. You say it, they say it. That's a normal, typical stage of development. But for apraxic kids, they don't really go through that stage. So they're listening, but they're not imitating. And it's true with the signs. It's true with the words. They don't necessarily just look at you and say, oh, she signed more, I'll sign more,
You have to really make them. You have to really set the expectation. And, again, you do it in a fun, playful, cheerful, upbeat, I want to make myself the most exciting thing in this room so that you don't feel compelled to go roll the car, over the windowsill by yourself and check out what's going on outside. As the adult, you have to make yourself so exciting and so fun to be with that they naturally want to stay with you. And if you do have a kid that, when we talk about early, and we talked about this a little bit last week with Glenn, how I decide what's important for a kid to want to sign for or want to talk for is just take a look at what he likes to do. As a therapist, we do home visits. Kate and I both primarily see children through our state's early intervention program, and so that means that we're seeing a child in his home, but that doesn't mean that I am not going to take some really cool stuff with me when I go for that visit to know that, I've played with 1 and 2 year olds for a long time, so I can generally decide, okay, I've got 10 things in my bag, and I bet you 3 of these things he's really going to like. And that holds true for most children, and you take those things and you start to play with those, but in order for that child to get a turn or to get to participate, you really do want to require them to say or sign something to get to do that. And, on my first DVD, Teach Me to Talk, there's a section about withholding, and we are typically kind of implementing that and using that approach all through a play session with a kid where we're kind of controlling what we have or a kid's access to that and really tempting him to communicate in order to get that access. So do we require a kid that's never, ever, ever said a word to say the word the very first time? Am I going to grab his Thomas out of his hand and say, you can't get it back until you tell me? No, we're not going to do that, but we're going to shape that behavior and lead up to, over the course of the weeks and the months to come, that he is going to be able to try to at least say that word or approximate it, get close to it. And again, signing is very effective for that, because even if he can't say choo-choo, if he wants it, if he's grabbing it, and he's got that whole gesture piece, then the next thing we're going to look at is teaching the sign for that, so that he, again, has to do something to get something. And then after he's gotten really good at signing that, and again, that could be over the course of several weeks, then we're going to want him to start to put a sound with that. And, you know, for some kids, if I think they're the kind of apraxic kid that can sort of get the vowel, you know, if I'm trying to get choo-choo, and the first time, few times they try, they're giving me, good enough. You know, we're going to take that. That's okay if that's all that he can do those first few times. And then we're, again, going to try to gradually shape that word so that it sounds closer and closer. And for a kid who's totally nonverbal, it is absolutely fine to accept an attempt, even if it's a vowel and even if it's the wrong vowel, as an early kind of request. And the thing about apraxic kids is that you'd want to so praise that and so reward that kind of attempt so that they feel compelled enough to try to, again, do that again.
Compelled, and I also think comfortable, because I think that, and maybe this is just my own interpretation, but it seems to me that a lot of the kids that I work with that I suspect are apraxic, they really do kind of have a wall about that whole communication thing. Not, you know, it's, they seem to have some instinct about it, it just doesn't come out right. You know,
right.
you know, mommy's been babbling to me for 2 years, and I try, and it is not right. You almost have to build their confidence to get them to say, to vocalize anything. You know, like you, they. Sorry, go ahead.
Oh, you go ahead. I was going to say you absolutely do, and some parents mistake that for stubbornness.
Mm-hmm.
They mistake that from, you know, we talk about this every week. They mistake it as it's a won't. I won't do it instead of I can't do it. And so, you know, again, you do have to get the kid through your relationship and through your connection with him to know that, gosh, you know, she's fun and I want to play with her. She is here with me. She's totally, her attention is on me right now. She's not worried about the phone and not worried about the things that are going on outside. She is so fun and totally focused on me right now. And, you know, sometimes that happens in one session with the kids. Sometimes it takes weeks and weeks of seeing a kid. And so as a mom at home, you know, you have to kind of set aside those play times so that kids kind of get that one-on-one time with you. Stanley Greenspan, who I think I put a D on the end of that, Greenspan, who is an autism expert, really calls that four time. And talks about that social connection and how important that is. And that kind of one-on-one time is even important for kids with apraxia, because they do have to kind of build that comfortable relationship where they feel like it's okay to try. And especially with, don't you find this, Kate, with kids that are really, really smart, that are apraxic, they're even worse about it, because
mm-hmm.
it's like on some level they know.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like you just said, I've tried this. My words don't sound like mommy's. I've tried.
Mommy
I'm
says
not...
ball. I say da, and she says no, ball. And it's like, oh,
I know.
You know, I finally got something out, and she told me I was wrong. And, you know, that's an obvious, common, would make sense why mommy would say no, ball. I always say yes, ball, so they hear it. But
yeah,
no, I'm not telling them no, using that N-word on them. But, you know, Laura, I was chuckling to myself, because when you were talking about making it fun, being playful, and I do, I think part of that factors into, and again, I think we talked about this when we initially introduced apraxia, that heightened level of arousal is so important for
right
for word kids get, you know, apraxic kids and even language related kids getting words out. But I seem to hear two things about myself as a therapist. One is she plays. She's really playful. They love her. She's playful. And then I just had a dad tell me last week that you make them do it.
Yeah. And that's what I'm talking about. You require it. And I just am about to take over for a little girl. She's had another speech pathologist, and the mother flat out said, I need somebody that's a little more aggressive than you.
Mm-hmm.
I need somebody that's not going, you know, that really is going to be able to find a way to, quote-unquote, make her do it. And again, if you've seen any of the DVDs or seen any of the clips, you know that we're not, you know, threatening to throw a kid off a balcony or holding them at gunpoint or anything like that. You just do it in play. And again, before they get the darn choo-choo, before they get the cookie, before they get the bubbles, you have to really set up that situation so that they want to sign it or say it. And then I had a mom last year when Teach Me to Talk first came out, and I sent several to some moms, kind of in the editing phase, and said, tell me what you think about this. And she was not a mom that I worked with before. She's just somebody that I had kind of built a relationship with over the internet. And she said, my therapist said that a kid with apraxia can't ever do a word under stress. So she said that all that withholding stuff is really wrong to do. And we've never done that because I don't want to put him under too much pressure. And my thought about that is some of these kids I could see for 6 months, and if I didn't put them under any pressure, they wouldn't do one darn thing.
Uh-huh.
So I take that completely opposite approach on that. And, again, it's not that you are being mean about it or that you are – again, it's not that I'm never going to let them have it. You know, after – 3 times, 4 times, 5 times, if they still can't do it, and if I still haven't found a way to take their little hand and make them sign or do something that I've asked them to do, I'm still going to let them have it. But I just think that requiring peace in a playful way is what makes the difference between success and failure in these early attempts with some of these kids.
I totally agree. I think, I have heard over the years, Laura replaces speech therapists. I sometimes work in conjunction with them, and I always love when I work with Laura because we have very similar viewpoints and opinions about these things. But sometimes therapists will tell parents, he'd be talking more if you wouldn't give him everything he wants. And they encourage parents to, quote-unquote, withhold. And what that can sometimes look like is, the mom has the choo-choo, and she says, if you want it, you'll tell me choo-choo. And here's a kid who's never said choo-choo, and he really loves them, but he can't say it. And she says, well, you didn't tell me. So, my therapist told me not to give it to you unless you say choo-choo. And that is so different from the really, really playful, really, really animated. It's almost, you kind of get into this whole routine of, your face says I'm having fun, and your body says you're having fun, and your voice says you're having fun. And kids do get that, even kids who are really very delayed get that pretty quickly. And they know, Laura's playing that game again. Kate's, but mommy's playing that game again. And they get excited, and they can do things that they couldn't do and they certainly aren't going to do if you just, that's the other side of withholding is you don't get it unless you say it, and I'm not going to do it. So,
we
are withholding, but it's totally different from the other kind of withholding. And, maybe that therapist who told that mom that's what she meant, but certainly do withhold. I certainly do withhold, and as you said, I always try not to push a kid to the point where he's having a total meltdown. That's not really therapeutic in any way.
It's
but
not.
A little bit frustrated, a little bit excited, sure, because that helps them get the sign out, get the word out, make some progress. So
And it gets their little bodies ready, and you talk about this all the time, Kate, and do such a good job of kind of bringing that point home on the show with you don't, with this kind of method where you're kind of withholding and you're kind of and you're requiring them to do it, it's not, you don't just all of a sudden take their favorite ball and say, Bob, you got to say it, you got to do it. It's that 5 or 10 minutes where you've bounced the ball, you've rolled the ball, you've kicked the ball, you've thrown it, you've jumped up with them and played and played, and you've thrown it behind the couch and gone to get it, and you've rolled it under the couch and gone to get it, and you've, bounced it on the ceiling, whatever you've done. And then that's when you take the ball. After you've gotten them excited and after you've gotten them going and after you've gotten them really wanting to play with you, that's the point that you take the ball and you decide, okay, what's my target here today? Are we going for the word? Are we going for the sign? What do I sort of think he's going to be able to do? That's why I almost always start this kind of thing with the word that I think the kid can already say, or a sign that I think that he's pretty much able to do. If a kid has no signs, I always start with more, because mm-hmm. most kids can clap. If your kids can hold the toy right in front of their body, if you've seen them clap with you before, they can do the sign for more. They have the physical capabilities to be able to do it. And then that's what you want to, quote, unquote, require a kid to try to do the very first time that you start this kind of method with them. Pick something that they're sort of going to be able to do based on what they've said before or what they've done before, you know, as far as thinking about, excuse me, what kind of sign might work. And you pick that, and that's the sign. And as you're holding their ball, you say, you got to tell me more. And you're putting your little fingers out there, and you're doing the sign right up beside your face, right while you're still holding the ball. If the kid doesn't do it, then you reach out, help him do it, make him do the sign for more. As soon as his fingers have touched, you immediately go into, yay, here it is, take the ball, woohoo, you did it. Then you play for another minute or so, and guess what? Then you take the ball back again. And you repeat that whole sequence. And if he tries to sign more on his own, again, you're going to give him the ball, and you're not going to let him keep it 15 minutes. You're going to play another minute or two. And by that time, the kid knows, aha, she's going to get that ball back from me. But it, when you've been so playful and you've stayed with him and you've really gotten into it and he knows this isn't just, you know, mommy showing up and faking it here, they do start to do things with you and make those attempts with signs and make those attempts with words, again, all because you've kept it playful and you've kept them wanting to interact with you. And again, for lack of a better word, you've required them to participate in a way by signing or talking before they can move on to get the ball back and have their turn. And I do think it's something that you have to practice. I think it's something that you can watch other people do and get better at. But then it's something that you have to kind of learn. You know, sometimes I feel like with a kid, I'm standing on a seesaw. And in one way, I want to be really playful and make no demands so that he wants to play with me. And then the other side of that seesaw is I'm totally making him do something that I want him to do. And it's a balancing act. I mean, don't you think you really, it's an acquired skill. You have to kind of do it enough so that you read your kid and balance being playful with requiring him to do it. And again, it's not doing something that's so difficult. You know, you would never say, have him, a nonverbal kid, you wouldn't really want to insist that he say, give me the ball, you know, on your first time that you've tried this. You're going to go with the ball, or you're going to go with the sign for more, or go with the sign for ball. You know, you want to make his first attempt something that he could realistically do.
Right. And I liked what you said. And I know we bring these same points up, but it all kind of ties together about starting with something that's easy for the child. And I try and remember that little tidbit routinely, because I do think my little analogy for that is, well, you wouldn't go run a 10K without warming up, you know?
Yeah.
We really are.
You have to have done it before, yeah. You know, that race day, yeah.
You know, these things are hard for apraxic kids. You know, I mean, the signing can be hard. The words are really hard, especially in the beginning, but even for some time after that. So if you have a kid or your child says more, says eat, or says daddy, or says ball, whatever word that he can use, let him say that a little bit. You know, give him some opportunities to warm his little motor up so that when you switch to a different word or a different sign, he's kind of stretched out. He's kind of warmed up. He's, you know, and I was, you know, they kind of hit their stride. And as we work with kids, we get pretty good at reading, okay, we're there. And that's
right.
When you're going to get your best successes. And then they sometimes kind of crash on you. They get tired. They get exhausted. We've pushed them. And then, you know, what I do in therapy is, okay, I'm going to shift gears, maybe do a little more targeted stuff on receptive language. Maybe I'm going to, you know, whatever. They do kind of just hit the wall. I mean, this is hard, and I don't think parents necessarily get that because
I don't either.
We're so much fun, you know.
I know. They think it's just playing. How hard could it be? But I tell parents all the time, it's just like the day that you took the ACT. You had to work your brain really, really, or SATs or whatever they, you know, whatever, you know, a big test in school. Think back to how exhausted you felt when you left, because it was a mental workout for you, and that's how our new talkers are. It is physically exhausting. And your point about we get them so up because we're playing and we're laughing and we're having such a good time, and they can get their sounds and words when they are in that heightened state of arousal, but it does take a toll on their little affects and their little bodies because they are quite tired.
Yeah,
after you've
sometimes
done that.
By the time I get done or I'm winding it up, writing my note and getting ready to go, I look over and, you know, they just look like they've been wiped out. You know, their eyes are all glassy. They're kind of laying there. And I think, ooh, you worked pretty hard. And parents, it doesn't look like work because it's so playful and the kid's
right, happy
and focused and engaged. And, you know, he's signing and he's trying to pop out words and you're looks like great fun. And it is, but it is hard work for them. You know, I don't think that's obvious to a lot of parents. I think they think, well, they're just playing. But it's hard. It's really mentally taxing for them to jump through the hoops that we ask them to jump through. Even though we're making it fun, it's still work for them, too. So.
Yeah, and it's often really work for parents, too. When you're first learning how to do this with your child, you'll be tired after those play sessions, too, because you're having to think ahead and think, okay, how can I make this just a little bit harder but not too hard? What word do I think he can sort of do? Because I kind of heard him yesterday sort of make an M sound. So if I heard him yesterday, that means he can really kind of do it. So, you know, your brain is working over time while you're doing this, and at the same time, you're smiling and you're laughing and you're trying to stay fun and na-na-na-na-na. You know, sometimes parents are that tired too,
right,
after they start that. And I think even, you know, when people first start to do early intervention or first start to, you know, work with our population, I think sometimes therapists can only see 3 or 4 kids in the course of a day. And they're wiped out because it is hard work.
Well, you know, I only like to, yeah. Early on, I did find it much more exhausting. Now I just don't always want to work so hard. But it is. It's hard to stay up and animated. You know, one of my standard lines is, well, I'm competing with whoever, SpongeBob or Bob the Builder or Blue's Clues or Barney. You know,
yeah,
you think of kids' cartoons. And I, at this point in my advanced stage, I almost find them somewhat offensive. They're just so loud and animated, and you know, but maybe it's just because I do that all day long that I really don't want to hear a cartoon when I get off. But they're, you know, they're loud and they're musical and they're, yeah, they're lots of action, and that's really what does grab most kids' attention. You know,
that's what it takes.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And so if you're just, you know, and compare that with if you're just going to sit down and look at a book, my goodness, which one is that 2-year-old going to pick? He's going to pick the more animated, more playful, more fun approach than, you know, you sitting there with a book. What's that? What's that? Tell me that. Tell me that. What's that? What's that? You know, gosh, I'm going to pick that, you know. So, again, that's kind of how you have to think of that. But if you want to see some of those examples, and again, there are other real specific things you could do, but today I just sort of wanted to talk about the philosophical approach behind that, and it is the foundational approach for kids with apraxia. You're going to be fun, but you're going to absolutely, quote-unquote, require them to do something to get something, and that's the thing that I think parents don't always get, and some therapists don't understand that either, but there is a way with toddlers and young preschoolers to balance it and make it fun at the same time. So check out the clips of the DVDs on teachmetotalk.com, or you can look at that on the Facebook fan page and see some examples of that. And we will continue to talk about this next week, same time, same place, next Thursday, 2 o'clock.
Well, it seems like we're always talking about this. This is,
I know,
for anybody, this is like our normal phone conversation. And then it's, well, listen what worked, listen what didn't work, and blah, 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 blah. We like to, this is our subject somehow, so.
We've been
anyway,
talking about this for over 10 years now, so this is not on the show, in our real lives, so yeah.
Yeah, real life, we have owned, T-Mobile, how many hundreds of dollars, because we've talked about this same topic. It's really, really fun to us, but if you're out there and working with little kids or struggling with your own child, these things really do work, and take a minute to look at her clips, because there is nobody who makes it quite as much fun as Laura. I know if I hadn't known you all these years, I wouldn't have nearly the successes that I do. So it helps me to see it.
That's very sweet of you to say.
No, I mean,
very sweet of you to say. Thank you.
You know, I attended the Laura Myers School of Speech Therapy, so.
That cracks me up every time you say that.
Would you please get that accredited? Because I really need that.
That cracks me up. Okay, one more thing before we go, and I think we're already off streaming live, but for our folks that listen from the website, in this next few days before the new Apraxia DVD comes out and for just 10 days after the release, I'm going to have a very special coupon code that I'm not even putting on the website. You have to email me to get that code, and I'm not even sure how much off that's going to be. Have you decided that yet? Okay. Never mind, sorry. But
it's going to be something off. And it's
something off. It's going to be a discount. And so email me at laura@teachmetotalk.com and put in the subject line, need coupon code for the new Apraxia DVD, and you're going to get the special discount and get those first copies that are hot off the presses. I've already had several speech pathologists email me about that, and I'm so excited. I love that people who do my job are excited about this project as well. So
did you
send me an email.
Names? Are any of them the people you routinely replace? So
No. These are people that I don't even know, that just, you know, from the website. Just so I've never had the pleasure of meeting them, and so it's so great for me.
It's no
to get
good
that.
Thing when they see it. Because Apraxia kids are not necessarily the easiest kids to work with. So even speech therapists sometimes really, really struggle. And your approach really does work. So they'll get it and they'll copy it.
Well, and there's so little out there for people who work with our population. I mean, there's lots of resources for older kids, but this early intervention niche, you know, it's different when you're working with a toddler versus when you're working with a five-year-old. And so, again, that's the reason that I did the website and all the DVDs is just to give those folks who are out there in the trenches like you and I are new ideas and a different way to do things. So if you were one of those speech pathologists who sent me that this week, please know that you made my day. Thank you so much. All right. I think
okay,
we're
thanks.
Off.
Talk to you later.
Okay, talk to you later. Bye.